This is Notepad. I'm your host, Ibrahim Sani. MTDC, or the Malaysian Technology Development Corporation Sdn Bhd, is a wholly owned company of Khazanah Nasional Berhad, and as an agency under MOSTI, or the Ministry of Science, Technology and Innovation, it was established in 1992 to encourage tech acquisition activities and to develop technology-based companies. Besides fund management, MTDC also provides an integrated support services for technopreneurs, which includes technology center management, technopreneur training academy or Tentra, center of nine pillars, and advisory services such as mentoring, soft landing, branding, fundraising, international collaboration and networking. Because of that, I have the pleasure to invite the partner of MTDC, which is the co-founder of Finology, that designs, develops and delivers fintech products, computer software, online services, and provides financial technology consultancy, here to share with us some of the ideas on digital banking. Jared Lim, the co-founder of Finology, joins us. Jared, let's start with our first question, which is, of course, on how the pandemic is influencing customers' transaction habits.
The issue here is that on 30th June this year, 29 applications have been submitted to Bank Negara by various companies on getting their digital banking license. On top of that, we know that conventional banks and incumbents right now are already rolling out their virtual banking services that mimics that of the digital banking space. Whatever it is, both incumbents and new entrants are trying to revolutionize and rejuvenate the big banking industry in Malaysia to enhance their proposition, to get more consumers to be financially inclusive, and to make banking a little bit more ease. With all this against the backdrop, how do you think the pandemic is influencing customers' transactions habit when it comes to financial inclusion, financial products, and of course, digital banking in this country?
So, Ibrahim, I think, as you know, the pandemic has affected almost every part of everyone's daily lives. And one of the things that we are seeing is that there is a huge boom in e-commerce and social commerce. I think that is undeniable. And one of the things that we're seeing out of this boom is that many people, including my own parents, right, and many seniors and above 40s, they are actually making their first, they're transacting online for the first time ever. So in this e-commerce boom, this social commerce boom, added on with that, you know, the government, they had this DANA, this they basically disbursed some social aid, some cash aid via the use of e-wallets. So what we're seeing is we're seeing cashless payments going through the roof. And a lot of them are new to online transactions. A lot of them are the very young ones that are also new to e-wallets, and they just want to get the cash on their e-wallets, right? So when they start using it, you see that the transaction behavior, the user behavior are getting to be very familiar with cashless transactions. Now, additionally, we are also seeing a very something that I did not predict, I did not foresee, but is happening, is that even investments are being democratized through all these new mobile apps that are coming on. Things like, I think there was this Go Plus, there is StashAway, there is Versa, there is even a mobile app by Afin Huang Asset Management, who have made investments available to everybody with a mobile phone. So yeah, it is really influencing customers' transaction habits.
Do you think that there will be some potential opportunities and challenges that incumbent banks can expect following this kind of movement?
Actually, there are plenty of opportunities and challenges. You know, in Chinese, they say that crisis is made up of two words. One of it is danger, and the other one is opportunity. So it's an amalgamation of two words. And we find it to be very true right now. Some of the spaces that are being disrupted by these challenger fintechs, we call them, is places like investing in loans, not all loans, primarily it's, I think, SME loans and the personal loans, whereas the secure lending space is still pretty much the domain of incumbent banks. We're looking at funding, crowdfunding, payments especially is being disrupted in a big way. And even today, you can say deposit taking. Now, all of the growth that have resulted from the pandemic and this e-commerce boom and the dana being disbursed via e-wallets, all of this growth of the new, we call them the underbanked segment or the new to all this digital banking segment has been today with the digital challenges. So the incumbent banks actually didn't see much of the growth over there. All of it or most of it have gone to the challenges. And they managed to capture a lot of new to financial services. Additionally, these challenges have also actually started cannibalizing on the existing banking customers, where they're moving more of their money away from the traditional banking system into this new fintech players. And banks, as another challenge, who are not digitally agile, they don't have any digital agility, they can't really respond fast to this, they will continue to lose ground. Especially for products and services that are can be templatized, that are simple, and where the challenges, the digital financial services have managed to make it more simple or more seamless. But this is where the opportunities are as well. And there are, I can say, three kinds of opportunities. The first one is for the incumbent banks to start partnering up with all this digital fintech. A good example is CIMB partnering up with Touch and Go Digital or Great Eastern with Boost. These are all good examples of partnering up with. A second opportunity or another way they can go about it is they can buy into one of these challenger fintechs, considering it an investment, which is also a similar track to what the Great Eastern did with Boost. And the last one is they could take the track of what Maybank does is they go into the race themselves for specific niches. For example, May by Maybank. That is basically going up against the e-wallet and going up with their own digital initiative. So these are the trends that banks can take advantage of, this social commerce, e-commerce boom, the familiarity with digital cash transactions, and they can then start looking into it. Aham, Afin Huang Asset Management, they have also started, in the sense, challenging the robo-advisors by themselves introducing their own investment app, this Afin Huang Asset Management app, which you can download and start investing also with one or two clicks of the thumb, you know. So, yeah, and seeing very, very good growth, actually very good take-up.
What do you think some of the key factors that banks must consider when it comes to realigning their digital initiatives? What would be some of the items that they got to rethink about how they do their work?
I think very many of the banks, right, when they are building their tech infrastructure and their digital initiatives, in the past, they built it very much to be a closed system. When I mean a closed system, meaning the only way for you to interface with the services is to have a user account to log in and use it within the banking, the bank's infrastructure, right? And also, their systems don't really interact very well with the external world. You have to be within their environment. Now, in the new era, when banks are working on their digital initiatives, I think it's very important to have open systems and to think about how they can make their interfaces more friendly to third-party systems. It's also very important for them to reimagine all their onboarding processes for customers and how do they make it relevant to a digital world? Because the one where you expect customers to go to branch, do a thumbprint, those are not very friendly in this new era. And we, in Finology, we recognize that it's very, very challenging for banks. It's not the same for the new challenger fintechs because they come up fresh and they can still straight build their infra and their stack based on the new digital era. But for banks, they have existing customer base, existing infra, existing processes that they need to take care of. So it's not such a simple move, you know. It's almost like swapping out a plane engine, right, mid-flight. You can imagine it's not easy. And the thing is that when they talk about these kind of digital initiatives, there's always going to be a very, very high capex at the beginning. And there is no immediate return on investment. So the shareholders, not all of them might understand. So there's going to be pressure from the shareholders not to, I mean, the executives are going to have to answer the shareholders on a quarterly basis. And you can imagine it's not going to be very popular if they invest so much upfront for no return. And it's also, unfortunately, not how the executives in banks are compensated, right? Because they are rewarded on their quarterly performance. So I think there needs to be a cultural shift and a rethinking at the banks on how they can maybe even incentivize their people to making long-term changes and shifts to make themselves relevant in the new digital era. And, you know, you can just view it as a cost of business, you know, to hedge against the risk of future irrelevance.
Welcome back. This is Notepad. I have with me Jared Lim, the co-founder of Phenology. Jared, we're going to continue on this conversation of digital banking. We know that digital banking can create a lot of value for customers. It can also reduce cost for banks and, of course, put the new entrants to the scene up and running because of low operational costs needed. But there seems to be an idea where customers' lives can be greatly improved. Opening an account, for instance, used to mean that, you know, we went to the counter outright. I remember the days when when I had to line up basically at the counter to open an account. Those days are gone. But there is a personalized treatment for high value customers. Do you think that these kind of value differences that customers can derive from conventional banking versus digital banking can be enhanced further through digital banking? Or do you think that people just don't want that personal stuff anymore? Everything is impersonal. It's okay. I just want my thing to be fast and running. What would be some of the behavioral challenges that you think is going to bring about this cultural revolution through digital banking?
Well, Ibrahim, I think the whole personalized service is the one area which digital financial services or digital banks can never, or you will have a huge difficulty trying to replace. Now, this is one of the, I can say, the advantages of traditional banking, which is when it comes to high value products, when it comes to services, which require advisory, personalized advisory, even personalized customization of for needs, right, to the high value customers. This one, I don't think any digital banking or digital financial services have been able to challenge yet. And I foresee this to continue to be the case because the advantage is personalization. Now, however, it doesn't mean that digital banking cannot provide value. In fact, it has been providing value in almost every area, especially where the services and products are simple and can be templatized. A good example is digital payments. It's so much easier right now to go out of my house, and it's happened a couple of times, where I forget my wallet in the house. I go out, and then I realize, oh, shucks, I need to pay now. And then I take out my wallet. I top up my e-wallets from my phone, and then I pay with a QR code. So that is value to me. That is already adding value. And then you also have the ones which bring down the cost of transactions for the everyday Joe. For example, a great Malaysian startup, Money Match, they have done wonders in bringing down the cost of remittances. There's Easy Transfer, there's Money Match, and This itself is already a huge value for anyone really using the services. And then there is lending as well. That's another place where they have added value. You think about it, for SMEs, a lot of SMEs who have started out in this pandemic, many who have lost their jobs and they started doing online food selling, maybe selling art and crafts online. A lot of these, when they go to the traditional banks to try and get a SME loan, you'll be surprised, Ibrahim, they actually cannot raise any loan because the traditional banking players today, all of them require like at least 2 years of running operations and history. And where do they go to meet this funding gap? They go to a wonderful player like Capital Bay, which is again a local Malaysian digital startup where they offer P2P lending for just SMEs. So if you ask the people who are using, myself one, using digital payments, have digital banking or digital financial services provider value, I can tell you most certainly yes. The convenience in some cases, the cost reduction in some cases, like foreign transfers, and for people like SMEs, it is life-changing.
The researchers that's coming out of digital banking is quite interesting. PwC research on virtual banking on Malaysian customers, they say that 74% of Malaysians are interested in becoming a customer of a virtual bank. PwC also says that those aged 55 or more are 2 times more likely to be interested in virtual banks due to a bad experience with their current bank. 77% are interested in additional services provided by their banks beyond financial products. So they don't want just a financial engagement, they want something more than that. Correspondingly, EY through May 2020 research shows that they want to leverage technology on how to move transformation opportunities post-COVID environment. And that the need for us to think outside the box, basically reinventing what the box is altogether, is also quite interesting to be looked at. What would be some of the ideas that you want to think about when it comes to reinventing this so-called box? How do we leverage on technology to boost everybody's experience moving forward?
I don't know much about what areas or what specific areas to reinvent the box. But I do know one thing. For the incumbent banks, we're not talking about the new digital financial services, because these guys, they know what they want to do. They know where they're going to focus already. And a lot of them have got very great traction. But if you're talking about the incumbent banks, there are definitely a few things that they must first do and look at before they can seriously start thinking they can make a dent in the or participate in the growth of this digital era, right? First of all, as already we mentioned, is that they as an industry, the individual banks, will need to spend or be willing to invest time and effort into revamping their internal infrastructure, the technical stack. And it's going to be a huge gargantuan effort to move away from the mainframes and the core banking and the applications of yesteryear. But the good news is that there is one bank in this region of the world that has successfully done it, where they completely switch off their mainframes, their core banking systems, and swap to a new one. And this is very recent. This is DBS in Hong Kong. I think about a month ago, the CEO of the bank, when he flipped off the switch of the mainframe, for the first time in the history of a bank, it became a big thing, and they made a whole news about it. So I think banks just have to start somewhere and relooking at their stack. And many banks already do in Malaysia. You can see they have their whole digital departments. But it's going to be a process and a multi-year journey before they move, completely swap out all the old parts.
It's so challenging. Yeah, we know that a lot of markets are very aggressive in trying to promote their digital banking. Where do you think Malaysia stack up between all these countries? Are we ready to go fully automated?
We are not the fastest, that's for sure. But many of the top banks, they definitely have started looking at the digital initiatives. So one of the things, aside from just updating your core infrastructure, is, remember we mentioned earlier the opportunities to partner. Mm. So many of these banks, even insurers, right, they can partner players or collective, what we call, instead of their challenger fintechs, and then their fintechs like us, Finology, who are collaborative fintechs. They can partner with collaborative fintechs like ourselves, who can help them transition into the digital era. For example, we could very quickly increase their digital distribution footprint. So instead of waiting for a bank to slowly move their stack, which means it will be 5 years later before they're ready, they can actually already start taking very concrete steps by working with fintechs like ourselves, and then start making their presence felt in the digital world.
Okay. Jared, final question here, and this is rather crucial for us to circle back to what you said just now. Some partnerships were done. CIMB and Touch and Go, you mentioned. AirAsia is also one of the participants that is quite aggressive in building their super app. And they are also one of the folks that submitted for a digital banking license. Digital banking and digital financial services is not just for banks. Do you think that this whole integration of all these services and using finance as a part of it is going to be the way forward for Malaysia?
I think so, yes. So you're talking about 29 applicants for the digital banking license, which Bank Negara will only give out at most, at this point, five of them. Now, for them, it's a gold rush because,
Just to keep in context, the Sarawak state government and the Johor state government also applied. So most likely, Bank Negara will succumb to the state pressures and give out these to the state governments too. So we're actually looking at 29 getting at most three. So it's not just, and it can be just one or two. So at most three, if Bank Negara feels generous about the whole situation. So yes, it's not a gold rush, Jared. It's a platinum rush, I think. Or a diamond rush.
We'll see. It isn't over until it's over, right? So yeah. Until we know.
Yeah. sorry. Go ahead.
Banking is not such a straightforward thing, right? It's not just because you're a state actor, then you can do it. You also need to have, number one, the traction or the buy-in, first of all. It's very important to already have a user base. And number two, the know-how. So, it could go to the state-owned entities who are also lobbying for the same thing, or it could go to those who already have great traction, or it could go to those with a banking consortium, for example, RHB Axiata is on a consortium with an incumbent bank, right? Mm. But what I would like to, how I would like to frame it is that, when the banking licenses, the traditional banking licenses were first given out to all the established banks of yesteryear, so until today, they sit on their licenses. It's a very protected industry, and nobody else can just come in and establish or start their own bank to compete. And in the meanwhile, they are there sitting and doing business and basically doing well for themselves. And there's this thing called the grandfather rule in Bank Negara where, you're not supposed to, or nobody is supposed to singularly hold too many shares in the bank. But for example, the exception will be the grandfather rule, like Tay Hiong Piao, because they are the founders, and then they can. So now, with the digital banking license being given out, it will be like the grandfathers of yesteryear who started the banks, and then they can sit pretty for the next 50 years. This is how people are thinking about it. You get your license 60, 70 years ago, and until now, you're golden. So that is why there's such a rush. But at the same time, it's not a guarantee. Because many of these digital financial services, these fintechs, are actually bleeding money. And not everyone, in fact, most in the world, have not yet shown an ability or a way in how they can turn profit. So they are pretty much investing into the idea that a couple of years from now, they will have so much scale, they will so much mass, that they will then be able to turn a profit by flipping on some switch or flipping off certain switches. That remains to be seen. So there is still a risk. It's not like the banking of yesteryear where today I give you $1 in a loan, then I expect back 30 cents, and that one is almost guaranteed make money. So today the competition is a lot heavier. It also means that anyone else, even without a banking license, can still challenge, just like how Bitcoin and all the digital currencies have taken off without ever getting regulated. You know what I mean, right?
Yeah.
So it also means there are players, or there will always be players, who might not respect the regulations and still operate anyway. And if the people who, because it's digital, it's so simple, I can do it from my mobile phone. If they like it, they would still flock towards it. And there's not much that the authorities can do. I mean, it's limited. They can always try, but it's still going to be limited. So not all of it will pan out. We've seen the same for the P2P lending licenses. I think six of them got licenses. It didn't. Not all of them became active or worked out. We've seen the same with the equity crowdfunding licenses. And we will definitely, I believe, see similar risk, reward, and play, and possibly even failures in the digital banking space.
Thank you very much. That was Jared Lim, the co-founder of Finology. If you've missed any part of this interview, just head on to astroawani.com, look for Notepad over there, or look for MTDC or Finology as well. Till then, thanks very much for watching, and goodbye.